So, good afternoon, and welcome to the second last week of term. It's the last lecture that I'm going to give in this lecture course. Next week we're going to have a second guest lecture. Paul Rayson, former colleague of mine from Lancaster, is going to come and talk to us. I have not, in fact, checked with him yet whether I'm going to be able to record this lecture. I'm assuming I can. If not, then I will still let you know, but if I can't record it, then it will also have no impact on exams, etc. Don't worry too much about that. I'll keep you updated. Okay, first a bit of admin. Please remember, deadline for assignment is today. I was originally intending to set a deadline for 11 o'clock, but I seem to have forgotten that because Frau Thielen's office hours finish at 11 o'clock. So if you haven't handed it in, please do so as soon as possible. One person has just given it to me. I was also somewhat surprised at the number of assignments that I've been given. My colleague, Professor Stubbs, who's giving sort of the parallel lecture in linguistics, he has a total of 8 assignments. I haven't counted mine yet, but it looks more like 50 to 80 to me. I don't know. But yes, so at least I know something to do over the weekend. But anyway, so I'll be looking at those as soon as possible. I try over the weekend, particularly for those people who've signed up for the exam, obviously, in the first week of the term break. And give you some feedback on that, however much I manage in that short time. But it is that kind of thing. Right. Someone's alerted me to the fact that the guest lecture that I uploaded... lots of whispering going on here. Shall we all whisper? Okay. Alerted me to the fact that the guest lecture that I uploaded wasn't the guest lecture. It now is the guest lecture. Sorry about that. At least it was another lecture. I don't know what other things I could have uploaded. But it's the right thing now, I think. Anyway, and last week's lecture files are now available too, the PDF and the audio and the video files in various formats. So everything should be there. And I'll try to upload today's lecture as soon as possible for those people who are not here, because I realize we're getting closer to the exam for at least some of you. Okay, so what are we doing today? Well, the topic, as I said, is historical corpus linguistics. I'm going to revisit a few things, not in detail, but a few things that have cropped up before in the lecture, and I'm going to look at things from the point of view of methodology, of how to analyze the history of the English language using historical corpus data. I am not assuming that you all know what corpus linguistics is, but then again, I'm also not going to give you an introduction to corpus linguistics here. I'm just going to mention a few of the important aspects or a few of the important keywords, and I will then move over very quickly to the question whether there is anything that needs to be focused on in particular when we're looking at historical corpus linguistics rather than corpus linguistics in general. I'll also, and this is something that I have to some extent very briefly already done, look at some of the historical corpora available in a bit more detail and say a few more things about them. I'll then return to a sample study which you have also very briefly also already been introduced to, namely tag questions, but I'm not going to give you lots of additional information, but I would like to look at some of the methodological issues that may arise when you do a study of tag questions on the basis of historical corpus data, and ask the question to what extent what I have presented to you is reliable or not. Okay. I'll show you one or two things on visualization. I'm myself not an expert on visualization, but for the assignment, I asked you, or I encouraged you, to visualize some of the data, perhaps using graphs or figures or tables and things like that. I will show you something else which I personally find very cool. I think cool is the best word for this, which can also be used to chart changes in the history of language in a very, well, visualized way. But you'll see. And then I'd like to return to the question of the spread of English. Remember that I talked about Indian English, and I talked about the fact that English has moved from being a very sort of small language in the sense of very contained, very small number of speakers in a geographically very restricted area, to being a world language. And I'd like to, just very briefly towards the end, mention a few points about looking at the history of these new Englishes using historical corpus data. Okay, that's the plan for today. Let's see. Right, now many of you will have, or almost all of you will have, been exposed to some extent to corpus linguistics in the introductory lecture. I had the last lecture, which was an introduction to corpus linguistics, which was a lecture that many of you didn't like in the evaluation. Either you liked it quite a bit or you didn't like it at all. It was perhaps the most technical or the most sort of research-based aspect of that introductory lecture course. But it was very introductory. It mentioned a few of the important points. And then I assume that perhaps in other courses that you've attended, you might have been exposed to corpus linguistics. So you're not getting a whole summary of what corpus linguistics is, but I'd just like to mention a few keywords, as I said. It gives you, and the important word here is authentic, it gives you access to large amounts of authentic language data. So it's not language data that is thought up while sitting in an armchair, but it is data that was collected with the purpose of being a representative subset of, or a snapshot of, the language that can then be used to look, to generalize from. One of the advantages of this is that the findings that you can make on the basis of corpora are replicable. They can be redone by someone else. They can be redone by yourself easily, of course. You wouldn't want to do that, I guess, but other people can go and check whether you've done the right thing, whether it makes sense. They are objectively verifiable. And this is what people typically mention as one of the advantages of corpus linguistics. And because they're replicable, I mean, they're replicable on the same data, of course, they're also replicable by using the same methodology, by using the same type of searches, etc., on different corpora. And you've seen this, for example, when I think earlier on I showed you comparisons between British and American English in the recent changes part of the lecture. So it's not based on introspection. It doesn't mean that introspection is completely useless, of course, but it means that it's not the only way of doing linguistics, and not the only method for relying on interpretations of linguistic facts. Introspection is, we corpus linguists believe, inherently problematic, because it is your own introspection, and you may be judging or you may be interpreting features of somebody else's language who, well, you simply are not. You are not a lawyer, you are not a coal miner, you are who you are, and it is difficult to put yourself into the minds of other people. In corpora, you get authentic language used by a very large cross-section of speakers of the language, and therefore it is, in that sense, superior to introspection, we believe. It also means that native and non-native speakers are, in a way, equally well equipped to do corpus linguistics. Naturally, you need to be able to interpret the findings, and you need to know a bit of the language in order to do this, but you don't need to be a native speaker. Okay. Right. These are some of the advantages, and they are generally acknowledged, and even people who are not using corpus data for their findings will have not too many difficulties with acknowledging them. There are, of course, also many problems, or at least potential problems, when using corpora. The concepts of representativeness and balance are very important here. Representativeness basically is one of the fundamental concepts in corpus linguistics. If you are using a set of data to extrapolate from or to generalize from, and that set of data is not actually a good sample, then what you're doing doesn't really make sense. But representativeness is a very difficult concept. Those of you who were in the introductory lecture maybe remember the questions that I asked back then. How much of which text type do you need? How much of spoken data versus written data, etc., etc.? So it's a difficult concept, but it's an important concept. Balance typically refers to the different types of texts or text types or genres or registers that are included. So you want a well-balanced corpus that covers lots of different areas of language use. And again, this is a difficult concept. There are other problems, very practical problems. You generally, unless you know how to program, you need to rely on the tools that are given to you by people who can program. Okay. Sometimes the tools may not do what you want them to do, and therefore they are limiting the way in which you can answer your research question. Okay. And they are also, interfaces to corpus data are always simplifications, they offer simplified searches rather than allowing you the full force of, a programming language like Perl or so. But anyway, this is something that you may want to evaluate. How much am I led by the limitations of the corpus tool in what I'm doing? It also means that very often people are simply tempted to do what's easy to do with a corpus tool rather than what's actually linguistically interesting. These are some potential problems. Now, all of these are true for general corpus linguistics, but they're also, of course, true for historical corpora. But these are not the ones that I would like to focus on. I may return to one of those or two of those later, particularly representativeness, but I'd like to make some additional comments about corpus linguistics when working with historical data. Okay, first of all, it's important to say that historical linguistics in a way has always been corpus linguistics, in the sense that people who have been looking at the history of the language have always been using authentic language data. Because that's all we have. Texts is all we have. We do not have the intuition of a contemporary of Shakespeare. We only have what Shakespeare and his contemporaries wrote. So we have to make sense of that. So in that sense, that's obviously not the definition of corpus linguistics, but one of the important aspects of corpus linguistics being having access to authentic data, well, that's what we've been doing in historical linguistics all the time. And introspection and intuition, your language intuitions are worthless when it comes to earlier stages of the language. I usually give people the example of, the houses being built versus the houses building, the example that I've given you in an earlier lecture, where all of you, I'm sure, feel very uncomfortable about saying the house is building. Your intuition is this is not natural, this is not grammatical. Well, as you know, 300 years ago it was. And therefore, your intuitions are really not helpful there at all. But of course, historical linguistics wasn't historical corpus linguistics. There are some additional features or additional gains by using large amounts of text. In fact, what we typically see in historical linguistics before the advent of corpora is that the same examples are used again and again and again. That's one thing. Or that you need to spend half of your life looking at lots of data, and I really mean half of your life. Some of the earlier studies were extremely time-consuming, and some of these early studies can nowadays be done almost at the click of a mouse within only, a few seconds, where earlier researchers had to spend years and years sifting data. Some of the older grammars that you may have heard of, Jespersen's A Modern English Grammar on Historical Principles is a marvelous work. It has hundreds and thousands of examples of historical data in context, not in context, of historical data as illustrations of features of the grammar of English, and he didn't have access to a corpus. There is an even more impressive work, A Historical Syntax of the English Language, which is literally, I mean, I don't know whether he had a social life. It's amazing. I also, in this context, usually like to mention pre-electronic corpus linguistics at its best. There is a study on the auxiliary do, the establishment and the regulation of its use in English by a scholar called Ellegaard in 1953. He does exactly what we do today in many ways by presenting quantitative data about the introduction of do support and its various forms. But back in 1953, he of course didn't have a computer at his disposal. And it is amazing, just to consider the kind of work that would have involved, but it is basically corpus linguistics. So people have done this kind of thing before. Nowadays, we can just use computers to do it much more quickly and much more efficiently. Yeah. So that's basically the point that I'm making here. Historical corpora as such do not increase our knowledge of the languages. They are based on manuscripts and editions available, yes. But it is now possible to collect and sort evidence with great speed and a high level of accuracy. Makes sense, I hope. Okay, one of the historical corpus linguists one of the earliest historical corpus linguists is Matti Rissanen. He's now retired. He was part of the team who introduced or who compiled the Helsinki corpus, of which more later in a few minutes. And he's come up with three problems that are important when looking at historical corpus data, and he's named them quite grandly, I think. But let's see what he has to say. One is the philologist's dilemma, namely the danger that the use of a corpus and a computer may supplant the in-depth knowledge of language history, which is to be gained from the study of original texts in their context. The point he's making here is that by losing access to what the texts look like, the kind of script used, the kind of book it was bound in, by knowing much about, where and how and what, etc., etc. I guess you get the meaning, get what I'm trying to say. You lose something that may be essential for making sense of the text in its social-cultural context. Okay. And he's got a point there. So, yes, we win from the point of view of speed, but we lose something that is part of the historical text. In fact, the same team, or the continuation of that team 30 years later, is currently working on a very large project which also compiles a historical corpus, but which, for every text that they include, add a lot of annotation, basically as much annotation about the text as possible. Who wrote it, where, under what social circumstances, not what color of hair did the author have, but I mean, if they knew, they would probably add it too. Okay? So it's basically as much as possible, plus, of course, the original, if they're available, electronic versions, the JPEGs or pictures of the original manuscript, in order to exactly counter this philologist's dilemma. Okay, the other one is named even grander, the God's truth fallacy. The danger that a corpus may be used to provide representative conclusions about the entire language period without understanding its limitations in terms of which genres it does and does not cover. Okay. I talked about balance and I talked about representativeness, but basically the danger is that we take the corpus to be representative of language without knowing what's in it. Okay. This is something that is dangerous for doing corpus linguistics about the language today, but it is even more important about historical corpus linguistics, because historical corpora, as I'll say in a minute, tend to be more restricted or tend to be much more representative of language in general than modern corpora. And then this is again a feature of corpus linguistics in general, but it is important particularly also for historical corpus linguistics, the mystery of vanishing reliability. The more variables which are used in sampling and coding the corpus, so the kind of annotation that's available, periods, genres, age, gender, etc., the harder it is to represent each one fully and achieve statistical reliability. Statistical reliability referring to the fact that differences between two corpora or two different subsets of corpora may look like differences. We've got 17 here and 5 here. That's more than 3 times as many. But, in fact, when looked at in more detail, turn out to be likely to be due to chance. So, in corpus linguistics, we tend to test for statistical reliability or statistical significance. And if you do this, you need a sufficient number of examples. And if you haven't got a sufficient number of examples because you have so many categories that per category you have only a few instances, then you're having a problem. I'm mentioning this in the context of historical linguistics, again for the same reason as with the second problem. They tend to be small, fairly small, and they tend to be limited in the sense that we can't simply add to them, because particularly for Old English, we don't have all that much data. So the most effective way of solving this problem is to build larger corpora, of course, but if we haven't got more data, that's a problem. Right. Staying with the concept of historical of corpus representativeness and balance, I've already said that the idea is that the corpus should cover or adequately cover a whole period. And I've just said that many of the historical corpora are limited. Also, and I think I've mentioned this in previous lectures already, it's restricted to written data. Some people have tried to and that's obvious because we don't have recordings that go back to further than about the middle of the 19th century. Some people have tried to use speech-like data, particularly people working in the field of historical pragmatics, looking at how Professor Busse was here, she's talked about this briefly, historical drama text, for example, and using them as spoken language, or at least as a proxy for spoken language. I think she also mentioned trials. Some people have also looked at parliamentary debates, Hansard. Okay. Now, to what extent is this useful? This is one, or to what extent is this reliable? This is the question that I asked Professor Busse, if I remember correctly. To what extent is this actually spoken language? Very often, if you look at parliamentary debates, trials, etc., we're looking at very formal settings. So this may be quite removed from the language that people spoke on the street. Also, particularly when we go back to earlier stages, really earlier stages of the language, Old English, Middle English, then you might have what's known as scribal interference. The people writing things down may have interfered with certain forms because they seemed, either to come from a different dialect or not to be sufficiently formal for the purpose. For example, looking at parliamentary debates today even, there is a lot of data produced generally, every day, from parliamentary debates, but very often the transcripts are actually fiddled with by the people making them public. For example, phrasal verbs are supposed to be very informal, and if a member of parliament uses a number of phrasal verbs, then in the actual transcript, people have looked at this, it may actually turn out that the more formal Latinate term is used instead. This is scribal interference, and it means that the data is not authentic. And I've said that corpus linguistics works with authentic data. some kind of problem here. Also, some of the trial transcripts may not be reproduced as direct speech, but more sort of speech-like summaries. Okay, so spoken language is definitely a problem. Another problem that I've already mentioned in, I can't remember which lecture now, I think it was the one last week actually, is the problem of genre continuity. I already indicated that with some of the Brown family corpora, it was difficult to find the same text types like science fiction across 30 years spans. This becomes much, much more problematic when we're looking at texts that maybe are 300 years apart, or in fact with newspapers, as I also mentioned last week. Well, there were no newspapers in the 15th century, so there is no genre continuity full stop. So you may have a corpus that spans 1,000 years, but it doesn't span the same language use because, well, certain language uses simply didn't exist. So how do you deal with that as a linguist? Because you're in a way comparing not just different times, but you're comparing completely different language uses. Okay, a few words about the precise dating of texts. Now, knowledge of the year of publication may sometimes not be available, but even if it is, how reliable is this? Because the writing may have happened quite a bit earlier than the publication. In fact, many decades sometimes can be found between what we presume must be the date of writing and the publication. And if we're talking about language change in progress, this is problematic. Also, we very often don't really know anything about the authors, and that will then be difficult when we want to interpret things from a sociolinguistic perspective. Let me stay with this dating of the texts in a bit more, well, for a minute or two more. How do we deal with dating texts in a historical corpus? Do we take the year of publication, or do we take the birth date of the author? This may not sound like a big difference to you, but in fact, if we're looking at language change, which may, in some cases, happen quite quickly, let's say one or two generations, it is a difference whether something that was written in 1772 by someone who was then 72 is dated as 1700 or 1772. Why should it be dated 1700? Because he did write it in 1772. Well, the idea here is that once we've acquired grammar, once we've acquired the language, we have certain fixed rules that do not change anymore. So someone who learnt English in 1832, or around 1832, will not have the same grammar as someone who learned it 50 years later, even if both of them are alive in 1870. So, there may be differences which then are sort of covered or which are hidden behind the date of publication. How many of you, can I have a show of hands, have heard about the difference between apparent time versus real time studies? No? Oh, that's surprising. Not a single person. Okay. Well, in that case, I need to quickly explain this because this is actually related to this. An apparent time study is a study of historical changes without historical data. So, for example, if we look at the British National Corpus and the spoken data, that was produced or that was recorded in 1993. Okay. And if we look at how a particular form is used, let's say, I mean, that's my example that I use in the book about BNC Web that I've co-authored, the use of the modal verb shall. Okay. If we do this, let me see whether I can actually... I'm going to use the blackboard in the lecture. Let's see. We might actually end up with a graph that looks like this. Okay, this is frequency, and this is young people, let's say, well, I'll just write young, middle, old, and very old, okay? All right. Now, how can I interpret this as a picture of language change? Or as an indication of language change? Well, the assumption is that we can read something out of this neat development here. What happens to the young people when they're old? Will they have suddenly started using the feature more frequently simply because they've turned old? Well, there are certain features that are age-related. There is something known as age grading. Certain features do tend to be acquired or lost in becoming older. Okay. Lexical items, for example, and certain other features. But most grammatical items, as I said, tend to stay the same. So, if we did that same analysis in 50 years' time, the assumption would then be that the people who were young back then and who are now not quite yet very old, but at least let's call them old, would still use it fairly with the same frequency, and the ones would be here, okay, and here maybe we would have nothing at all or very little. Yeah. So we still see the same development in across the different ages, but now the whole frequency has sort of moved down. Yeah. This is no longer on the same level. This is higher up in frequency here. So, we can read the snapshot, which was taken at a particular time, at one particular time, let's say 1993, as a result of language change in progress, whereby older people are representatives of older periods of the language, and younger people are representatives of younger periods of the language. And that's why it's called apparent time, because we're not actually having the time. We're not sitting there for 30 years and waiting until they turn older and then check whether they still use this. But we're reading something into that graph. A real-time study is one where we really look at different periods in time and where we check the use by people in 1930, 1960, 1990, and today. And that's why I say that the dating of text in historical text may be maybe important, because if you take an apparent time approach, then, as I said, 70 years difference may be actually a very big difference. So it basically messes with some of your interpretations depending on how you interpret the data. Yes?
Isn't it possible to include both kinds of information?
Yes, it is possible to include both times, both if you have both of this information, and that's what in fact happens. But you need to be aware which one you choose when you interpret the data. Yeah. So, yes, you're right. In principle, there is no problem if you've got the information and if you know what's in your corpus and if you know whether you're doing a real-time analysis or an apparent time analysis. Okay? Right. Whoops. We know the problem of editions, I guess. You're doing literature, you've been, many of you are doing literature, you've been exposed to the fact, I think, that Shakespeare will have, or has, not written what you read nowadays, but that this is actually something like an artificial or synthetic product, which is the result of editorial work based on different copies that are given to us. And that may actually, not given to us, that are left to us, I guess, or that survive. And that may actually, it's not a major problem, I think, but it again has some impact on the authenticity of the data. So all of this is not actually the fault of corpus linguistics, but you need to take care of them even more so perhaps in the historical context than with modern corpora. So corpora don't replace brain work. You need to have some, in fact, some additional brain work is often needed to make sense of the data. Like, for example, is it date of birth or date of publication? Okay, some practical issues. Some of you will already have been exposed to this. Those of you who've used the historical data for, or used the Helsinki corpus for the assignment, will have had to struggle with spelling variants. Okay. Some of you also wanted to look only for certain, well, for the word as a verb rather than as a noun. And that is not possible in the Helsinki corpus because it is not part of speech tact. These are practical issues that need to be overcome, and there are no immediate solutions. People are working on solutions, and in fact, next week, as I think I've told you already, you're going to be presented with some approaches towards solutions relating to spelling variants. And once it's normalized, once it's spelling normalized, you can also part of speech tag things automatically, at least to some extent, on historical data. So comparability of findings I've got in brackets here because that's basically true for all for all corpus data, but for historical corpus linguistics, it's even more important to look at whether the two sets of data that you compare are actually comparable. Okay, those were some methodological issues, and I'd like to now move over to a few major corpora. I've mentioned them before, some of them. But I'll, as I said, I'd like to say a few more words about them. The Helsinki corpus, the mother of all historical corpora, so to speak, it was the first historical corpus that was electronically available, compiled in the early 1990s. It's got, I'm not sure whether I've mentioned this concept before, this long and thin approach, meaning that it covers a lot of time, it covers a millennium, basically, about 1,000 years in the history of English, but it is fairly small. It contains about 400 text samples with only 1.5 million words. 1 million words amount to about, 7 or 8, I think, medium-sized books. So it's not a lot of data if you consider that this is supposed to cover 1,000 years of the history of the language. It contains 11 sub-periods and 3 major periods, Old English, Middle English, and Early Modern English. And even though it's old, it's just recently turned 20. There was a symposium in Helsinki last year that I went to celebrate 20 years of the Helsinki corpus. And it's still a very useful starting point for any diachronic study. It's too small, so you need more data for many aspects, but anyway, it's a good starting point. And in fact, quite a few of you contacted me and said, I don't have enough data in the Helsinki corpus, can you send me some more? Now, I wrote Helsinki corpus original here. This is, of course, not the original. This is not what the manuscript looks like, but what I've tried to reproduce here is the original spelling with the graphemes that are no longer available. Now, today this is absolutely no problem. But back in the early 90s, there was no Unicode, so they opted for ways of indicating thorns, for example, with a plus T, etc. And this is hell to search for in the interface that some of you have used if you don't know that this is how you look for a thorn. So these are practical problems that nowadays shouldn't really happen anymore, shouldn't be there, but they are still with many of the older historical corpora. How do you look for spelling variants? How do you look for graphemes that no longer exist? Yes, representativeness, as I said, fundamental. It requires that the, and this is a quote from Biber, that the target population is defined. Target population in the sense of what am I trying to represent? The complete population of Northern England, okay, or all newspapers published on a daily basis in the south of England or something like that. That would be a population or something that I would like to represent. Now, and then we have sort of a random sampling of that whole population. But we don't really have that for the historical data, of course, particularly with the whole Helsinki corpus. It cannot even remotely capture what would have existed in Old English, and also with Middle English. So really, it is very limited what we have, but it's all we have. At this symposium last year, a new version of the corpus was released. This is not the corpus that is available to you over the interface that I've given you access, or some of you access to. It is now a new version, an XML version, which is released in 2011, fixes some errors, but also adds a lot of annotation that makes searches across different text types more easy. It's still not normalized for spelling, it's still not part of speech tagged, but it is a modern version of a corpus classic. Yeah. It is also now Unicode, so you can actually just look for a thorn by entering a thorn, if you know how to do this on the keyboard. The Icelandic keyboard settings help quite a bit there. Okay. Right, that was the Helsinki corpus. I'll give you a few minutes or 2 minutes break in a minute, but let me go on with a few major corpora first. Archer, I think I may have mentioned this before. It's a historical corpus as well that basically takes off or starts when the Helsinki corpus stops. It's again fairly small. It covers the period from 1650 to today. It is what I have currently, still only 955 texts, but we're going to get a new version that's got some new texts that has been fixed. Certain things have been improved. That's coming soon, probably still this year. Okay. I'm not sure whether I've mentioned the Zen corpus. Did I? Gosh, am I? I did check. I don't think I've... Okay, well, anyway, then maybe I didn't check in the right place. Okay, so I'll do this very quickly. If you've seen this already, restricted corpus of Zurich of newspaper data. It's not obviously comparable to the Helsinki corpus, but if you want to compare it, if you want to compare it to the Helsinki corpus, you need to make sure that you're really taking care of the fact that you're dealing with two completely different types of text collections. But I don't think I mentioned the Lancaster News Books corpus, did I? No, I don't think so. I sometimes mention this as an example of a very restricted or very specialized corpus. It actually only covers texts from a very short period of time. It is related to the early developments of the newspaper. But it's pre-newspaper, sort of at least newspaper as we know them today. It was compiled for a specific purpose at Lancaster University by Andrew Hardy and a colleague to look at how texts in early press writings have been reused. But of course now it is an electronic text collection that can be used for other purposes. Much, much more restricted. But just to give you an example of sort of what else is available. Then I did mention the OED quotations database, and I also said that it is not a proper corpus. And I already showed you this link to a paper where I look at this in more detail. The problem there is, of course, that the quotations were not selected according to linguistic principles to be representative of a particular language use, but they were selected in order to show, to illustrate a particular meaning. And therefore, the combination of it isn't a proper corpus, but it is still a collection of authentic language use, so it might be used within a corpus linguistic approach. Right, then some of you have received some data from me which I've taken out of the Chadwick Healy drama corpus, which is a collection of drama texts that I have, which I cannot make available to you because of licensing restrictions. but it's 50 million words of spoken language, and what I typically do when students need data is that I do the searches for them and just basically send them the output. And many of you actually got much more data than even you bargained for. I gave you several thousand instances rather than just 100 that you're looking for. But then you just select, from different periods, a small subset. Another corpus that I haven't mentioned, and that those of you who've been given access to the interface at Lancaster already have access to, is the Paston letters. This is basically the correspondence of a family at this period of time. So it's late Middle English, very early Modern English, 1422 to 1509, at a particular place near Norfolk in England. It's interesting because it contains data from both male and female writers. We have fairly little data for female writers in earlier stages of the language. It also, it's not speech-like in that sense, but it is closer to speech than formal registers. Again, it's not a corpus that was selected to be representative, but it is an extremely important or interesting set of data for people who are interested in the development of historical social linguistics, in the development of aspects that can be related to social linguistic factors. Two more, and then I'll give you a break. I think it's two more. This one I mentioned, I'm not sure whether I've mentioned it before, but I mentioned it, and I usually am very frustrated while mentioning it. It's a wonderful collection of data, 600 million words, and nowadays it's in fact even more, I think. It's more than a billion words nowadays of basically printed books from the time of the printing, the invention of the printing press to late modern English. The people in Lancaster have access to it. All universities in England have free access to it. It would be really nice to have it. It's not a corpus as the other texts, but it's so much data that you can't ignore it, but it's not available in Trier. I tried to get it here in Trier, and it's one of the silliest things that I've ever done, I think, because it was available in some form via a web interface, and then I contacted the people and asked whether I could have the raw text files, which is what people in England get. And then they noticed, because I asked, that the trial account, which was given to all the universities in Germany, which was supposed to be only for a couple of weeks, had simply been forgotten. And because of me, I think, all universities in Germany cannot have access to this data. So I felt really stupid about it. But anyway, yes, okay. This slide you've already seen, so I'm not going to talk about it anymore. It's basically the historical data for the 20th century, which of course adds to the historical data that we have for earlier centuries. And before I now go into the sort of sample analysis and mentioning a few more methodological aspects there, I'll give you a 2-minute brief. Okay, let's return to this. And as I said, the example is the example of tag questions, and I'm now just sort of showing you the slides and not telling you everything that I told you before, just to remind you of this. So here about polarity and tag versus anchor, etc. And the kind of thing that I showed you before was that you can then use, for example, the English drama section, the English drama corpus, to look at frequencies that of that particular feature in time. Okay. Now, as I said, I want to use this example to discuss some of the methodological issues that we have. Before I do this, I'd like to revisit a problem or revisit a question that we did when we talked about tag questions. So we've got different ways here of, well, saying the same thing, not saying the same thing, but of forming tag questions. Dost thou not versus did not I? What's different? Well, the placement of not. Where is the negation? And did not I, of course, sounds very similar to didn't I, which is the tag question as we know it today. And I already showed you back then a version of this chart where I indicated, or where I said that one of the forms, did I not, decreases while the other one increases, and there is a period in time where did not I, with the, this is the contracted form here, didn't I, and the did not I is frequent, not frequent, but exists in low frequencies for a bit more than 100 years. Right, now what do we make of all of this? How reliable is this data? What comments do we need to make? Well, I've already problemized the question that this is not spoken language, of course. But how speech-like is drama really? It is written to be spoken. It is, after all, supposed to be spoken on stage, and it is supposed to represent interaction between characters on stage. Now, this is a real question. I mean, this is, I think, something that you could do if you ever wanted to do a really nice joint PhD between literature and linguistics. Mm-hmm. We know about literary theory, and we know about literary conventions, we know about different stages in the history of literary development having different conventions. Mm-hmm. To what extent is this aim to be natural on stage, or to actually give the impression that we're talking about real conversation, different in different periods of the language? I don't know. Is modern drama particularly, is it supposed to be very close to natural conversation? Or is it perhaps at some stage, not modern drama, but was drama perhaps at some stage so conventionalized to be very, very formal that maybe it was never the aim to be particularly speech-like? Now, if things like that come into play in addition to looking at language change proper, then I think the data becomes even less reliable. So this is one of the big questions. I would love to do a paper with a literary colleague at some stage about this, but I think it's more than a paper. It needs a decent, as I said, it's probably a PhD. So something for you in the future. And this is something that I've basically already referred to when I spoke about that last graph in a previous lecture. How reliable is the written representation of what goes on in speech? Did not I? Was that really did not I? Or wasn't it actually supposed to be didn't I? But is it as a result of standardization or early standardizations or convention that people didn't write the contraction even though the contraction existed in spoken language? So these are questions which have an impact on the reliability of what really looked like a nice graph. Yeah, this is the kind of data that you want to find when you're doing historical linguistics. Opposite development, something in the middle showing, people haven't made up their minds yet, but maybe it is actually not as straightforward as you think. Sometimes there are also real questions that are really hard to answer. This is the data for British drama, again, a shorter period of time, from 1700 to 1900. And you see a very clear increase. Now, I also have a comparable set of data, for American drama. And as you can see, it starts off with lower frequencies, but then American drama overtakes, or it becomes much more frequent in American drama in the last period, in the 20 years after the turn of the century, 1900 plus, American English drama exhibits twice as many tag questions per million words than in British drama. However, today, and I think I've talked about this, in American English, tag questions are far less frequent, 9 times less frequent, in fact. So what's happened here? Why is American drama 100 years ago apparently something, well, a genre or, well, if you take it to be spoken language, why do Americans use it twice as frequently 100 years ago, but 9 times less frequently today? Is this because of a development in the language, or is it simply an artifact of the data that I have? Perhaps again, of the fact that English drama in 1900 was different than English drama in the sense of drama written in English in America. I don't know. Okay, polarity, I also... Whoops, let's see. Hey. Ah, okay, sorry. Polarity, I think I already talked about very briefly, and I made the point that there was a time when positive-positive polarity was the most frequent option around 1750. I think I did mention that already. And I made the point, I think, that this may be related to function. Okay. To function meaning to pragmatics. So I realized when I looked at the data that there are a lot of instances where positive polarity tags, meaning it's positive-positive, so the anchor is positive and the tag is positive, are used in contexts where there is some kind of aggression going on, where there is a challenge going on. I know you. You will tell a different tale tomorrow. I'm a coxcomb. I'll punish you, okay, or I'll kick you, or shaking him violently by the collar, etc. So I found quite a lot of those instances where I interpret this to be an expression of a pragmatic force. Okay. And I've tried to use this data to look at function changes in the history of tag questions, from question to tag. And I think this is a slide which I've already shown you. So from a real question like here to the kind of uses that we have today, she will be in trouble, won't she? She often gets her drinks anyway, where this is very, very different. It's very far removed from a real question. Okay. Now again, when we look at this type of data, we need to ask a related question. It's not exactly the same question, but a related question. How reliable are authors of drama texts in general in representing the reality of authentic language? So it's not just how good is it supposed to be, that's one question, how close is it supposed to be, but how good are they at representing it? If I asked you to come up or to invent a conversation that might happen outside in a pub or something like that, how good would you actually be at representing something that is authentic? And I think you would find it difficult, even in German, to make it sound like or to make it be very natural. So to what extent can we actually interpret what's going on in historical data, even more so in historical data, as being authentic language use? Because what we might actually see is sort of the clichés of language use rather than real language use. So that's another methodological question for you. I don't have an answer to this. I don't know. That's maybe the second part of the PhD that you're going to write. But anyway. Okay, those were some methodological questions, and I'd now like to move over to my second last thing for today, which is a few aspects of visualization when it comes to historical corpus linguistics. You've already seen tables, well, you've produced tables, and you've seen figures. I've just shown you one or two about the development of tag questions. And figures are very, very good ways of visualization. I'm not saying that there has to be a figure in every paper, but figures manage very often very easily to show a development if it is a sort of straightforward development. But isn't there anything more fun? Yes, there is. Okay. When I saw this for the first time, I was really quite fascinated by it, and I still like it very much. This is something that is developed, or that was shown for the first time by Martin Hilpert, who is still at Freiburg, but he's now accepted an assistant professorship in Neuchâtel in Switzerland. And what he's done is he's used a feature which I think is provided by Google, and which is a visualization of historical changes that now looks not very cool, okay? But wait. Because what this is it's a moving visualization. What we have here is a time axis from 1870 to today. This is based on the corpus of historical American English. So it's a corpus that I think I've mentioned before, but that wasn't part of the overview here. And what this is looking at is collocations of certain verbs, like modify, mount, move, multiply, lots of different verbs, with either might or may. So I might say this or I may say this. Okay. This is not the most linguistically interesting question, but this is something that I would like to show you, because over time, things might change or may change, right? How do you visualize this change? Well, very easy. For each word, you come up with a nice graph, but then you've got hundreds of graphs. Okay. So what he's doing, he's putting all of this in one graph, in the sense that each of these bubbles refers to one word, and the bigger it is, the more frequent it is. And the more it co-occurs with might, the higher it will be here, and the more it co-occurs with may, the further it will be on the x-axis. So if something moves out from here to here, then it simply becomes more frequent, but with both. But if something moves from here to here, then the frequency of co-occurrence with may disappears, reduces or goes down, while at the same time, if it moves up here, it becomes more frequently used with might. Okay. Let's see what happens. Let's look at the word say, by the way. Okay, down here you can see the figure. Okay. So say is almost exclusively with might. No, not exclusively, but very frequently, and then for some reason it moves down again. Yeah. Isn't that cool? So you can select each word individually, but you can now visualize over a period of 200 years how certain features, how certain very frequent features develop on two dimensions at the same time. Yeah? Shall I play that to you again? I have two more. Okay, but anyway. So, very frequent first with may, but then might say becomes much more frequent, and may say is still around, but and then sort of may say becomes even less frequent, and might say seems to be the more common collocation nowadays. And as soon, I mean, this is not particularly interesting for say, but you now have basically the whole picture about all the verbs together, and you suddenly find perhaps interesting things. Again, something that is not linguistically particularly interesting, but where you can nicely show how language use and certain sociocultural facts can be plotted against each other. This is a lot of words, which can be both nouns and verbs. So change is a noun, but you can also change things, of course. Telephone is a noun, but it can also be a verb. Phone is a noun, and you can also phone someone. Do you phone someone today? Well, you usually call someone today, perhaps on the phone, but even that. So, obviously, you wouldn't expect telephone or phone to be in the corpus before the before the invention of phone, or the telephone. So that's why we start down here. The words telephone and phone are both at zero. Now let's have a look at what happens when telephone and phone become part of the language. And do you expect them to be first introduced as nouns or as verbs?
Nouns,
okay, because the thing was developed, but then you start using the phone, okay, fax was first a noun, and then you fax someone, email, then you email someone, you telephone someone. Now, do you expect telephone or phone to be used first? Telephone, obviously. Yeah. Have a look at what happens with the verbs telephone and the verbs phone. Which one do you expect to win out? Phone, because that's people are lazy, etc. Now, all of this isn't really particularly surprising, but we can visualize this very nicely. Okay, invent it, telephone, but only as a noun, and then the verbs come in. Right, and this is phone, and now phone wins out while telephone is moving further into the non-verbal and only the nominal. Is it only me who finds this fun? No. Anyway, okay, I'll give you the next one, the last one, and then I'll leave that. Okay. It's starting already. I'll tell you what it is. This is the word academic and democratic. And can you say academical, democratical? Well, you could in 1810. And the fact that you found it in the middle means that it could be both ical and without ical. But then sometime around 1900 and later 1950 or 60, in fact 70, okay, only for academic, it moves into, down here, which means that all of these verbs, all of these words cannot be used with ical, but only with ic. Okay? So this is morphology visualized. By just doing this, and in fact, if you've got the corpus data in nice tables, which can be very easily got from corpus searches, doing this is a matter of minutes. Okay. And in fact, you can use it as a visualization to actually explore things that you would otherwise, in the masses of data, simply not see. Because you've got hundreds of verbs here, and you will very easily see which verbs stand out. Not verbs, words in this case. Okay. So, I like this, as you can tell. It means that visualization doesn't always have to be boring tables or figures. Okay, last topic for today. As I said, I'd like to look at corpora or historical corpora in the history of New English. As I already, in the lecture about the spread of English, talked about Indian English as a new variety, which has its own features, which has its own stabilized, standardized features, which is no longer directed in terms of norm giving towards the mother country Britain, but which has developed its own features. And of course, using corpora, and I did show you one or two corpus results there, can be very helpful there to chart those differences. But what about the historical development? This is at the moment a pet topic of mine because I'm in the process of compiling a historical corpus, and that's why I'd like to show you a few slides here in this context too. All of the corpora that we have, or virtually all of the corpora that we have, are inner circle variety corpora when it comes to historical corpora. So, native speaker variety. But what about the development of such second language varieties as Indian English, Singapore English, Bangladeshi English, Hong Kong English, etc., etc. Here's a quote from Capture, which I'm not going to read out now, but which basically say there is something standardized, there is something general pattern-like about those new varieties, which therefore can be found in corpora. And remember, I gave you an overview of the five phases in the dynamic model proposed by Edgar Schneider about the identity formation from the point of view of the settlers and the indigenous people in the development of new Englishes. And new Englishes are at different stages. Hong Kong English is fairly early on, stage 2 or 3. Indian English, as I mentioned, is somewhere between 3 and 4, so it is becoming more endonormatively stabilized than Hong Kong English is. And in Singaporean English, we see currently a move over to a native speaker status. It's probably closer to 5. In fact, it is no longer an outer circle variety, in my view, in many ways. But quantitative investigations of the development of these phases are currently virtually restricted to apparent time studies. So we've got this term, apparent time studies, again. We only have present-day English, and we tried, when we work with this data, we need to interpret what we see as a result of a language change. But there are additional factors in the context of new Englishes that make this even more difficult. What are these problematic areas? Well, first of all, we need to distinguish, or we would like to distinguish, between what we could call mistakes or errors or, well, learner language phenomena, and something that's actually truly a new development, okay? Genuine nativized regionalisms. So some work that I've done with colleagues in Gießen and Zurich is that we looked at certain light verb constructions, sort of take a look, have a fight, a couple of others that I got a blackout again, but with give, for example, is, give a damn is something perhaps even more idiomatic, but give a damn is not actually literally giving. The give is empty, it's a light verb. Okay, take a look, you're not take a look, but yeah. So that's why it's called light verb construction. It's semantically light. Okay? We found, for example, have rest, not just in one variety, but we found it in 3 varieties of South Asian Englishes. It seemed he was having rest after a long day of work. We didn't find hundreds of them, but we found some. We found enough to ask ourselves whether this is a localized variant of a light verb use. So, is this a non-native error, or is it a nativized regionalism? We don't know. We only have the data that's available, and we cannot really go back in time and see whether this happens again and again, or perhaps didn't happen at the beginning, and then over the last 20 years or so becomes more frequent. Something that I think I already mentioned in the context of New English is that we don't know whether we're dealing with fossilized features that are simply leftovers, well, colonial lag is, I think, a term that I used before, leftovers from earlier stages of the donor language, of the settlers' language, or whether it's a real innovation. Remember that I gave you the example of the ditransitive use of inform. Inform the appointing authority. Inform and then plus... inform the appointing authority the amount of monthly installments. So we've got 2 noun phrases, a prototypical ditransitive construction. And I already made the point back then that we find examples like this in Charles Dickens. So it could still be an innovation, or it could simply be that it was taken over from earlier periods of the language and has always been in the new variety. We don't know. We'd also like to know more about first language interference. Take a call, as in answer the phone. is a light verb construction that we found in Sri Lankan English. When I asked to take a call to my office, I was told that both parties were tapping the line. Okay. That was a mistake. It's not actually take a call and receive a call, but make a call. Sorry, make a call. So it's the use of take instead of make, yeah? Which is clearly odd. Yeah? But this can be explained, we think, by the fact that we have interference from substrate languages, from first languages in the area. In both languages, the equivalent of English take can be used in the sense of make a call. Okay. So is this always the case, or is this a new development? What is it? What's the status of all of this? Well, there's a missing corpus. We have historical British English corpora, Archer, Blob, and all those that I've shown you before. We've got corpora of present-day English, like the BNC, and we've got corpora of new Englishes, like the International Corpus English, newspaper corpora, and all those kind of things that we can compile from the web. And we can compare them, and we can look at what's happening, and we can try to make sense of it. Okay. And in fact, we can compare, well, both across time and across varieties. We can compare directly between present-day British English and present-day Indian English, for example. Okay. But the interpretation is problematic because earlier stages of both varieties are not considered. As I've just said, I mean, we see the differences, but we can't really make sense of them. We can compare the input variety, namely the historical way, the historical version of British English, and we can use this to make more sense of it, but there are still too many open questions. Okay. We don't know whether inform somebody something actually stayed in the language and still is, or whether it developed independently from each other. We don't know. If we had a historical corpus of new Englishes, then this could provide important input on possible first language interference, because if it is first language interference, we would find it in the early stages. If it isn't first language interference, we would only find it later on when the development of sort of endonormatively stabilized features becomes part of the language. I'm not saying that. Well, it's not as easy as that, but let's keep it at that, because first language interference, of course, might lead to the new features being standardized, but I think you get what I mean, or at least I hope so. And then if we had this historical corpus, we could compare B and D, so the historical corpus, which you can't really see here, but which is somewhere there. I think you might just sort of make it out. I can see it nicely on my screen here. Yes, could provide additional input to facilitate a distinction between non-native mistakes and nativized regionalism. So, it would be really nice to have this. Ultimately, only a combination of comparisons involving all four types of corpora will allow researchers to capture the full picture of the development of a new variety of English. A diachronic corpus of one or several new varieties of English is thus necessary to confirm Schneider's evolutionary stages and to investigate the development of new Englishes in real time and not in apparent time. And that's what I'm foolishly trying to do at the moment, because so far it's been rather frustrating, but we're working on it. I don't like this acronym at all, IHCPV. It's the International Historical Corpus of Postcolonial Varieties of English. I had to read that up. It's not, you can't really understand what it means. If you can come up with a better name for it, like Zen for Zurich English Newspaper Corpus, or Blob for Before Lancaster Oven, let me know. We're currently working on the non-fiction part, going back to the 1950s, and I'm still in discussions with, and I've recently made progress there, discussions with the people in Singapore to include historical newspaper data, etc., etc. What do you need to consider when you do this? What period do you cover? How far do you need to go back? Do you need to go back to 1800 or so? Or is it enough to start in 1950, which is what I'm planning to do? In 1950, a country like Singapore will have been at a stage when very few people spoke English, apart from the settlers, but not in the indigenous population. What kind of data do you need? Quantities. If you're looking at Singapore, how much Singapore literature, how many legal documents, what newspaper archives. So the whole question about representativeness comes in again, but it is even more difficult because within 50 years the situation changes so much. It's almost like making a historical corpus like the Helsinki corpus, which covers 1,000 years, but you only cover 70 years in the case of Singapore English. Usual question about proportions, etc. Can we use what we have in the Brown family of corpora as a sample or as a model? Okay. Also, should I include only locals or should I include people who lived in Britain? Is it who moved over from Britain and who are British nationals? Remember, we've got the indigenous strand and the settlers who are both part of this identity construction. So I've decided to include both of those. In fact, I decided to include books that were published in Singapore, regardless of who wrote them, simply because it means that people, it was produced for a Singapore market, and therefore it might have had an impact, even if it was written by, I don't know, an Austrian who lived in Singapore, written in English. And social linguistic information is quite difficult in some cases, and I'm not quite sure to what extent this is important. For example, ethnicity will be very important, but I will probably not be able to get at that information. Okay, so this is a different type of historical corpus. It's not really historical in the sense of the Helsinki corpus, which covers a whole millennium, but it's almost the same in some other respects because we're looking at the dramatic development of the English language from being a minority language for the elite towards a native language for almost the whole population. And in that sense, it's also a historical corpus that covers a very, very large, a great development. And therefore, in that sense, it's part of historical corpus linguistics as well. Okay, some references for you, and that's the end of today's lecture. Thank you.